From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talk with the great soul and gospel singer Al Green about his life before and after he was born again. Also today, we speak with a member of the Presbyterian Church's Committee on Human Sexuality, which urged the church to take a more liberal stand on sex for singles and gays, a stand the church just rejected. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Dying Young. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Supreme Court has ruled that states may ban nude dancing from bars, theaters, and other public places. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
In the words of Chief Justice William Rehnquist, states may require that dancers wear at least pasties and a G-string. Rehnquist's opinion was one of several in which the court, by a 5-4 vote, upheld an Indiana public indecency law banning nude dancing. The Kitty Cat Lounge and its dancers claimed that the law interfered with their First Amendment right to freedom of expression. Today, the Supreme Court agreed that the dancing was not obscene and was protected by the First Amendment. But the Chief Justice said the state's interest in protecting health, safety, and public morals is unrelated to the suppression of expression, since public nudity is the evil the state is seeking to prevent. The court's decision marks a major turning point in First Amendment law and probably means that productions like Hair will also be curbed. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev used his persuasive skills today to fend off a power play by communist hardliners in the Supreme Soviet. Gorbachev has been fighting a proposal that would have given emergency economic powers to Prime Minister Valentin Pavlov. Communist conservatives had sought to increase Pavlov's authority because he favors a slower pace of economic reform. The Supreme Soviet voted overwhelmingly against the measure after Gorbachev delivered a speech attacking his critics. Today, Pavlov denied that he'd been seeking extraordinary powers and said he had no disagreements with Gorbachev. Some 500 delegates to the International Conference on AIDS in Florence, Italy, followed Americans out of the meeting hall in a march on the U.S. consulate. They were protesting the Bush administration's immigration policy, which threatens to derail next year's conference, scheduled for Boston. NPR's Brenda Wilson reports.
To make sure that there was no confusion in Washington about the position of the organizers for next year's conference, Chairman Max Essex of Harvard University spelled it out in unequivocal fashion.
There will be no conference in Boston unless all American travel and immigration restrictions against HIV-infected people are removed by August 3.
Not all international organizations agree with many U.S. activists that Health and Human Services Secretary Louis Sullivan must lift immigration restrictions as well. Essex expressed concern that no conference in Boston may have the effect of silencing the people who should be heard from, those bearing the brunt of the epidemic in the developing world. I'm Brenda Wilson in Florence, Italy.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 11 points to close at 2,965.56. This is NPR. The State Department has rejected a North Korean offer to allow international inspection of the North Korean nuclear program. The North Koreans said they'd permit inspection of their program if the United States would submit to a similar examination of its alleged nuclear arms in South Korea. State Department spokesman David Denny said there's a clear world consensus that North Korea must abide by international inspection requirements without condition. Denny refused to confirm or deny whether the United States has nuclear arms in South Korea. Palestinians in the Israeli-occupied territories appealed today to foreign governments to save the lives of Palestinians facing death in Kuwait after being convicted of collaborating with Iraq in the Gulf War. Yesterday, Kuwait's martial law courts handed down 8 death sentences for collaboration, bringing the total death sentences to 29. Most of those condemned are Palestinians. Patricia Golan reports from Jerusalem.
Palestinian lawyers and human rights activists, who usually devote their efforts to fighting the Israeli occupation, held a news conference in Jerusalem today to demand the death sentences be rescinded. They also want the safety assured of some 200,000 Palestinians still in Kuwait. Fatah Azam is a lawyer with the human rights organization Al-Haq.
Al-Haq believes that a considerable measure of doubt exists as to whether the accused in Kuwait have indeed been tried in accordance with due process and whether proper judicial procedure was followed, including the right of appeal.
Azam said the treason trials were taking place in a highly charged political atmosphere. Palestinians here charge that the Kuwaiti trials are politically vindictive, and they're calling on the UN, European countries, the U.S., and the Arab League to intervene. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
Military officials in Sri Lanka are blaming Tamil rebels for a suicide car bomb attack in Colombo. As many as 60 people were killed. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Al Green's moaning ballads of the 1970s were about as great as soul singing gets. But now when Al Green sings about love, it's his love for a higher being. After becoming rich and famous with such hits as Tired of Being Alone and Let's Stay Together, Green was born again. In 1976, he was ordained and became the pastor of the Full Gospel Tabernacle in Memphis. By the end of the decade, he had virtually given up performing secular music and sang only gospel. Tonight he'll be singing some of his gospel songs at the Academy of Music in Philadelphia as part of the city's jazz festival.
Every day I'm gonna keep building up, sending timber up there every day. But I need the Lord to guide my feet and to help me make it along the way. On my holy faith. I wanna keep building up.
Al Green, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, do you feel that it's still inappropriate for you to sing secular songs? Like some of your old greatest hits type of songs?
Well, I'm opening the show with L-O-V-E Love. Yeah, right. I'm opening the show with L-O-V-E Love. So we're going to go from there. I was doing a show the other week in Jackson, Mississippi on Capitol Street down in Jackson, Mississippi, and I must have lost my mind, went crazy or something. I sung Sitting on the Dock of the Bay.
Really?
By Otis Redding. So they said, Reverend Green is singing Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. Man, he is cool, man. So we just kept singing and having fun. I think if you sing songs that bring people together and magnify love instead of hatred, I think you might do okay.
Are there songs of yours that you won't sing now?
Yeah.
Which ones?
Well, I can't sing some songs because I wrote them because of I Love You, Baby, Darling, I Care for You. You know, I wrote them because of sensual love. I want to take you in my arms and sweep you off my feet, put you on a plane, go to a nice resort area with a cold bottle of champagne and kiss you. Mwah, 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 mwah. I wrote them because of that. And then, but now like Let's Stay Together, I wrote for couples because whether times are good or bad, happy or sad, whether we're right or wrong, forgiveness is in there. And we can always make up. That's always a lot of fun. And we can go on with our lives being what we're supposed to be.
Now, how do you feel when you hear your sensual secular songs on the radio?
I feel kind of funny, and then I kind of blush, you know, because I've spent so much time under the book now. And so when I hear some of those songs, I kind of blush, you know, and I go, did I actually say that? You know, here I am, come and take me. Well, I did it because of I was so flamboyant, and I was so kind of had an air of arrogance, you know. And I sung it because here I am, come and take me. You know what I'm saying? And you know how that is. And so I learned to be more humble, more giving, more loving, and more understanding, you know, in that, yeah. So it's a little different, but still strong.
Well, Al Green, I'm going to play Let's Stay Together.
Let's play that.
That's something you still sing, right?
I still sing. I'm singing that tomorrow night.
Okay, here we go. My guest Al Green and his hit recording of Let's Stay Together. Do you remember how you met Willie Mitchell, who was the person who signed you to High Records and produced all the hits that you had with High?
Yeah, I remember how I met him.
How'd you meet him?
I met him in the country out in Midland, Texas, in Odessa, Texas, out there. I met him out there. And, he asked me about going to Memphis to sing on a recording because he worked at a studio. And we were riding in the car that day, and I said, how long do you think it'll take me? I was so flamboyant. I don't understand how I did it. I was riding with this guy, and I says, how long will it take me to become a star? He says, and he swallowed and like choked, right? He says, a star? Well, about 2 years probably, if you really work at it. I said, excuse me, let me out. I don't have any kind of time. He says, you're not serious. I said, I'm serious. I don't have 2 years to waste on practicing to become a star. I need some money now. And really, so he took me down to High. He says, this kid's gonna be phenomenal. They says, how do you know that? He says, because he's got it in him. And so he borrowed $1,500 for me from the president of the company to get me a place to stay and all that, and says, I want to work with him because he's gonna be phenomenal. Just watch.
Gee, it really pays to have chutzpah, huh?
I guess I just told him I wanted to be what I wanted to be.
Now the first song that he asked you to record was a cover of the Beatles' "I Want to Hold Your Hand," right?
Would you believe that?
It really is hard to believe. Why did he choose that?
I have no idea.
What was your reaction to it?
My reaction was good. I thought it was a great song. It was a wonderful song, but it was for the Beatles. I sung I Want to Hold Your Hand. I sung Driving Wheel. We was trying to find Al Green. That's what we was trying to find. Who is this guy? Who is this guy with the high falsetto and the rough voice? And Willie says, I tell you what, don't sing with a rough voice. I said, well, what do you want me to do? He's cutting all these different songs about different people, just a lot of songs. He says, sing mellow. Don't sing hard. Sing mellow. And I just went out there and started singing, I'm so tired of being alone. And I'm so tired of on my own. Help me, girl, as soon as you can. And I looked in the studio mirror. They have this glass, right? And you're looking at the engineers. Yeah. And everybody was jumping up and jumping up and jumping up. And I says, well, I must be doing something right. So I just keep on saying, people say. And that's, I don't know how that started. That's the way it started.
Well, that was your song. It was a song you wrote. So you already had it written.
Yeah, I said, well, after we got done cutting all these other people's songs, the Beatles and, and all these blues songs and the Temptations, I Can't Get Next to You and all these songs, I says, I got a song too. So Willie says, oh, please. Because he'd been cutting all day. We'd been cutting all day. It was 1 o'clock in the morning. I says, I got me a song and I wrote it on my own. So Willie told one of the guys, go out there and see what he got, would you please? I got to have a drink. Willie had a little shot of vodka or something. And after he went to feeling better, he says, all right, what we got out here? And it was this song, Tired of Being Alone. And I worked it up with the band. And I sung it, and it became our first million seller.
Well, I'm going to play it.
Let's play it. Come on. Let's play it.
This is Al Green's first big hit, a song he wrote, Tired of Being Alone. That's Al Green, my guest today, singing Tired of Being Alone. I want to get back to a story you were telling before we heard that about, you know, how you had to sing I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Yeah.
It was your first song. How did you sing that? I mean, what voice did you use?
I don't know. I just kind of sang, hey, you got that something that I think I understand. When I feel that something that I want to hold your hand. I want to hold your hand like that.
That sounds great.
I sung it in 71. That was 19 years ago.
Right. Right. So when you wrote Tired of Being Alone, were you alone? Were you tired of being alone?
Yeah, well, my girlfriend kept leaving me the key and leaving the apartment. And she would leave me a lot, and I says, well, how? It was snowing one night. It was snowing, and I had all the windows open because I was there by myself for hours on end. And I says, well, how can I do something with this? How can I make something out of this? And so I took a pencil and started writing it down because I was angry, and I was writing, I'm tired of being alone. I'm tired of on my own. And I wrote several other things. I scratched those out, and I said, help me as soon as you can. And then I went to getting serious about it. People say that I found a way to make you say that you love me, which is I don't have to make you. If you really love me, you'd be here with me. And I was writing on that connotation. You didn't go for that. It's a natural fact.
Had you written songs before?
Maybe one song before, that's all.
Oh, so this was something like newly discovered when you were recording this?
Yeah, everything was discovered at that time because we didn't have anything to, to no resources to kind of go back and say, I can do this or that.
Singer and preacher Al Green is my guest. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Like the bird in the sky. Oh, I can buy anything that money can buy. Oh, I can turn a river.
Al Green is my guest. One of the records that you made that was a cover of another recording was To Sir With Love.
Yeah.
And this had to be, like, when you saw the movie, you had to think of this as, like, a real corny song, right?
Yeah.
You had such a great version of it. Was it your idea to record the song?
I always wanted to record the song for years.
Why?
And I don't know. I heard this lady sing this song on a movie, some lady from England, and I heard this song. And I wanted to sing that song. And nobody was interested in letting me sing it. My producer says, come on, you don't want to sing it, sir, with love. They would always figure out a way how to cut me off, you know. Well, let's everybody break, you know what I mean? So we never cut to Sir With Love. So I says, when I got my own studio, you know, after I came to the point where I wanted to sing gospel, Everybody in Los Angeles and in L.A. says that's a bad idea. Everybody in Memphis said, oh, God, he's not going to try something else. I said, but I've got to sing gospel. I'm born again, and there's a lot of good that can be done from singing gospel as well. I went to my studio in Memphis, set up a studio, had Bill Cantrell to put it together, and recorded The Lord Will Make a Way and all those Highway to Heaven and all those songs on that same album in a makeshift studio. And that was the pivotal point in the Al Green career of things. But since then, I've come to know Al Green. I've come to know myself better. I've come to know.
So you recorded To Sir With Love during that session?
Mm-hmm. During that time period, during the next two albums there, yeah. I cut it because I want to cut it so bad.
I'm going to play it.
Let's play it.
This is To Sir With Love, sung by my guest, Al Green. Reverend Al Green is my guest. There's a story about you that's kind of legendary in music lore. And I'm thinking of the story of the time a woman you were with poured hot grits or hot oatmeal or something
cream of wheat
on you while you were in the bath and yeah. Scalded you and then took her life.
Yeah.
She killed herself afterwards. Is there a connection between that story and your being born again?
Nah, not whatsoever. People in journalism like to say that that was the reason, but I was born again in 73. This incident happened in 1974, so it really don't correlate, and they like to have it to be so that it correlates, but it doesn't. I was born again because they saw what I could be, not what I was. They knew what I was. I was a no good, woman hunting, champagne drinking, good time having, Saturday night, blues singing man. But they says, I'm not interested in what you are. What we're interested in is what you can be. And so I was born again on that premise.
How soon after you were born again did you become a minister?
I was born again in 73. I ran for 3 years trying to keep from becoming one, and I started a church in December 1976.
So when you became a minister and started a church, did you have the church built? Was it a building that already existed, or did you have it built?
No, I was in a hurry. I went and bought the church. Time I saw it, I says, didn't know what church it was. My mind was in such a turmoil. I was a star. I could go anywhere. People know you. But I was spiritually so turmoil. I was in a suite, in the best suite in the house, a presidential suite in Holiday Inn, Rivermont, in Memphis, upstairs, praying in the middle of the floor with a preacher. I needed to go and do what I was time for me to do what I needed to do. So when I went to the office the next Monday morning, there was a preacher came by. He says, are you Al Green? I said, yeah. He said, I was sent over here to talk to you. I said, by who? So he says, you want to start singing, start preaching? I said, yeah, let's go find a church. We went and looked on the market and found a church. I took out a check out of my pocket right out of here, bought that building. The next Sunday we had church.
So you paid for it from money that you made as a music star.
Right, just like Dad.
Since you were a star, and you still are a star, but I mean, when you started the church, people knew you as Al Green, you know, soul singer.
Yeah.
Did you have a lot of people showing up, especially early on?
Yeah.
Just to to hear Al Green
still
sing.
Still do. Yeah.
So how much do you sing in the church?
I sing quite a bit, but I also, when they come, I also drop the bomb. Yeah. That's it.
You don't let them off easy.
No. I catch them with that voice, and I hold them with that voice, and then I tell them what they, and they wind up agreeing with me.
Do a lot of people, including record producers, try to talk you into making secular records again?
Yeah. Yeah.
And do you ever consider it?
They tried to talk me into it the other day, yeah. I consider it.
So tell me, now we're recording this on a Thursday.
Okay.
And the day after we record this, you're going to be performing at the Academy of Music in Philadelphia.
Okay, let's go.
Now, at the Academy of Music, are you going to be preaching at all to
No, friends? I don't preach when I go out to do concerts. When I go to do concerts, you go to do concerts. You go to do revivals, then you preach. When you go to sing, you go to sing. There's some things that make just beautiful sense. Now, I may say some things, but I'm not going to preach. No, no. You come to do a concert, you do the concert. So we're going to do the concert.
Al Green, it's really been a pleasure to meet and talk with you. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Singer and preacher Al Green. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Love and happiness. Yeah. Something that can make you do wrong, make you do right. Yeah. Love. Love and happiness. But wait a minute, something's going wrong. Someone's on the phone, 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, talking about how she can make it right. Yeah, happiness is when you really feel good about somebody. There's nothing wrong being in love with someone, yeah. Oh, baby, love and happiness. Love and happiness.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. This month, the governing body of the Presbyterian Church overwhelmingly rejected a report calling for more sexual tolerance. Other churches are facing similar debates over issues like homosexuality and premarital sex. Coming up, we talk about the church and sex with Sylvia Thorson Smith, one of the authors of the rejected Presbyterian report. Also, the tearjerker Dying Young opens in theaters today. Our film critic Stephen Schiff tells us if he shed a tear. Well, not a lot of suspense there. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Moscow, Soviet leader Gorbachev has blocked an effort in parliament to give emergency powers to his prime minister, turning back efforts of those who would like to slow down economic changes. The Soviet parliament voted 262-24 to drop a plan to give special powers to Prime Minister Pavlov. Hardline lawmakers had sought to boost the prime minister's authority because they support his plans for slow-moving changes. On a visit today to Yugoslavia, Secretary of State James Baker voiced strong concern about conditions in the country. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli reports from Belgrade.
James Baker's visit to Yugoslavia was seen by many observers as an 11th-hour effort by the international community to preserve the unity of the Federation. Next week, the republics of Slovenia and Croatia plan to announce their independence from Yugoslavia. Baker said the United States will not grant diplomatic recognition of the new states and warned against unilateral acts that could preempt negotiations for what he called a new basis for unity. But after meeting the federal prime minister and the presidents of Yugoslavia's six republics, Baker said U.S. concerns about the country's future were not allayed. He stressed that instability and the breakup of Yugoslavia could have very tragic consequences not only here but also in Europe. And he expressed strong concern about history repeating itself, a direct reference to the bloody civil strife that raged in this country during the Second World War. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Belgrade.
Even though the Greek government has now lifted emergency measures in Athens, pollution readings again exceeded danger levels and prompted harsh criticism of the Greek government. Tasia Kavadias reports from Athens.
Deadly was the word one medical official used to describe the record heat and pollution that have gripped this city. The government suspended emergency driving restrictions to accommodate thousands of students entering Athens for national exams. While pollution levels dropped slightly from yesterday, hundreds were admitted into hospitals. Responding to charges that the Mitsotakis administration was unresponsive to the severity of the problem, government spokesman Viron Polidoras urged the press to downplay accounts of the situation. "I urge you not to exaggerate the problem," Polidoras told reporters, "especially now, during tourist season." For National Public Radio, I'm Tasia Kavadias in Athens.
In Washington, by a vote of 5-4, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that states and local governments may stop nude dancing in bars. The ruling applied to a law in the state of Indiana, which the high court said did not violate free speech protection. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 11 points to close at 2,965.56 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. State Department officials say that Kuwait has not met all their concerns about trials of those accused of cooperating with Iraq. Spokesman Richard Boucher says important questions of due process have been raised by defense attorneys, by human rights groups, and by others. He added some of these concerns have been met, but others have not. Several Western nations have indicated concern about the trials in which so far 29 people have been sentenced to death. The government of Kuwait says the trials are fair. On Capitol Hill, the Senate Commerce Committee has held a hearing on a bill that would impose sanctions on nations that use high seas drift nets. These long nets catch and kill millions of sea mammals and intercept millions of young fish, thus depleting commercial harvest. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold has more.
Miles-long monofilament nets hang like curtains in the sea, trapping everything in their paths. Fishermen and environmentalists who are against their use call them ghost nets because often they break off and sink, floating and fishing forever. Massachusetts Senator John Kerry had harsh words for the State Department today for failing to enforce a United Nations-ordered moratorium on the use of these nets. Kerry supports a bill that calls for sanctions against countries caught drift netting.
There are no teeth today, and that absent teeth, countries like France, Ireland, etc., are jumping into the fishing process. That rather than stopping it, it is continuing, and continuing with a flagrant disregard for the intent to get rid of it.
The Japanese squid fleet is the biggest user of these nets, along with fleets from Taiwan and South Korea. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The government says that the country was over $53 billion in debt last month, raising the federal deficit for the year to some $175 billion. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. This is a period when several churches are debating sexual morality. In July, the Episcopal Church will decide on proposals relating to sexuality and the clergy. A panel of the United Methodist Church will soon recommend whether the church should continue to oppose homosexuality. The Evangelical Lutheran Church will soon issue a report on chastity and homosexuality. One set of sex-related recommendations was overwhelmingly rejected earlier this month by the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church. The recommendations were included in a report issued by the Presbyterian Church's Committee on Human Sexuality. My guest, Sylvia Thorson-Smith, was selected to be a member of the committee because of the past work she's done for the church on women's issues. She co-wrote and edited the report, which recommended the church stop restricting sexual activity to marriage alone and celebrate other forms of committed sexual intimacy.
We did ask to rethink the whole standard of sex in marriage only as ethical. We think that we need to rethink the idea that only relations that are in marriage and the fact that somebody are married or not, that sets an ethical standard. We think that needs to be looked at again because it's the substance of relationships. It's whether relationships are what we call justice-loving that determines whether they're ethical or not. And we see those relationships, some of them definitely within marriage, but also we see relationships that fit that criteria that aren't in marriage among single people, among gays and lesbian people. But we do not sanction just any sexual intimacy that's not in marriage. We have a very tough ethical standard that we proposed, what we call an ethic of common decency, that has seven different principles of fidelity, mutuality, consent, responsibility, bodily integrity, the goodness, valuing the goodness of our created sexuality and that it's life-enhancing for both people. All of those criteria need to be established and relationships need to be attested by them, whether they're married or not.
Who would be the judge?
Well, we believe that people are free and responsible to be the judges of their own sexual relationships. We think that we are given that kind of freedom, certainly as Christians. We are free people, and we believe that Christ came and taught us to love each other, with justice and with fairness and with right relatedness, that we're called to do that in our personal relationships and certainly in our church community. And so we do believe that people are free, but they need to be responsible.
I would guess that a period like ours, in which there's a lot of sexually transmitted diseases, including AIDS, isn't the best climate to be suggesting this kind of reform on sexual issues.
Well, certainly we have a chapter in our report about AIDS and the compassion that is needed as well as the advocacy for victims of AIDS and those infected by HIV and all sexually transmitted diseases. We need a lot more work as individuals and as a church to respond to the AIDS crisis and to advocate that the government do more. So there certainly is the climate of sexually transmitted diseases that influences all this. But we also want to value our sexuality. I think one of the difficulties with AIDS is that it very powerfully links our fears about sexuality and death. And we don't want to be led by our fears into damaging sex negativity, where we fear all sex and that we sort of clamp down harder and with more control. We need to value our sexuality, but we need to learn how to live with that in responsible and life-enhancing ways. And we think that that can be done, even in an age where we are fearful of disease.
What's the Presbyterian stand on birth control?
Oh, we have a long history of being very affirmative in terms of people's freedom and responsibility to make decisions about procreation. The Presbyterian Church has long been advocates not only of the individual freedom to maintain and use contraception and birth control, but we believe that people and our public policy is also that there needs to be widespread access for people who choose to use birth control and contraceptive methods. We also have a long-standing policy of close to 20 years supporting women's rights with regard to abortion. We are a pro-choice denomination, and we support public policies that maintain women's freedom to make those choices. We believe that people need to have a choice and freedom to be responsible over their reproductive decision-making.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sylvia Thorson-Smith, and she was a member of the committee that authored the report on human sexuality for the Presbyterian Church, and their recommendations were just voted down at a meeting of the General Assembly of the Church earlier this month. We'll talk more about the report after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sylvia Thorson-Smith, and we're discussing a report that she co-authored and edited on human sexuality for the Presbyterian Church, a report that was voted down earlier this month at the Presbyterian Church's General Assembly. Well, another controversial recommendation made in the report is that gays and lesbians be received and accepted as full members of the church. What is the Presbyterian Church's stand now on homosexuality?
Well, since 1978-79, the position has been that we repudiate homophobia. We are not to be irrationally fearful of lesbians and gays, and we are to welcome them as members into our community of faith. And yet we have still on our position that homosexuality is fundamentally a sin, and that homosexual behavior and expression is sinful, and therefore that self-avowed practicing homosexuals cannot be ordained. And one of my very serious disagreements and sadnesses about the General Assembly was that that was, in a sense, reaffirmed. A line was included in the pastoral letter that we continue to abide by this position, as though this General Assembly reaffirmed that of sorts. We worked very hard in our report to help people rethink the issues of lesbians and gays, to look at the Bible with different eyes, to see this as a justice issue, much the same as we have looked at other justice issues. We have rethought how the Bible interpreted issues of race and slavery. We did that over a century ago. We, in this century, have rethought the issues of women. Our denomination ordains women and has as elders since the 1930s and as ministers since the 1950s. We had the same struggles around those issues on what does the Bible say, what is the authority of the Bible, and can we reinterpret the Bible. We try to help people see that we think the Bible needs to be reinterpreted on issues of homosexuality as well, that it is fundamentally unjust to relegate gays and lesbians to second-class citizenship and membership within our church. And as long as they cannot be ordained, as long as they cannot be free to say who they are among us, we think that is just a serious injustice, and I'm deeply grieved that this is continuing.
I think your report is considered the most radical of the current reforms being suggested in American mainstream churches. Did you consider toning it down a little bit, hoping that, it might get more acceptance if it were toned down?
Well, we certainly knew the politics out there. We knew the pressures from the time we started working. There were lots of fears about what our committee was going to propose. As any group in a church works on these issues, there is so much fear around sexuality issues, and we were aware of that. But we decided as we were doing our work, and I think it's a testimony to the integrity of this work, that we were all people of faith that were called to do this task for this particular time, and that we had to be moved and led by what we believe to be faithful, a good and faithful word for our day. You know, these are people with deep faith convictions that this is indeed, you know, God's word around sexuality issues as we've seen it and as we offer it for others to talk about it. And we know that it's not the last word. We know that it's not the only word. We know that it does not reflect the views of all Presbyterians. Certainly you can see that in the division in our church. But it is our best word, and we felt moved to say what we were called and led to say, and not to sort of play to pressures out there that would have us tone it down. And I think that it will stand the test of time as a really rather historic moment, that this word is part of a conversation that's going on, but that lots of people are finding it a very hopeful and useful word, and I'm proud that our church has offered it.
I'd like to ask you to reflect on what you feel you're up against trying to get change in religion. And after all, religion is based on upholding tradition, and the religious principles are based on the Bible and ancient texts. So, I mean, reform is a very slow and often difficult process in any religion, I think.
Well, we certainly have that to deal with. There are always the tensions, I think, certainly within religion, but in the culture at large, whether you're talking about politics and government or religion. There are the pressures to maintain the status quo, but there are also the voices of change. And the church, in its tradition, has had both. And we belong to the Reformed tradition. Presbyterians stand in the tradition of the Reformation. John Calvin and Martin Luther were voices of radical change. Much of what we don't understand is how radical their new views were about sexuality. They took a major turn in saying that celibacy, and particularly the celibate clergy, were no longer the ideal for Christendom, that clergy could be married, and that sexuality was reaffirmed as something good. We stand in that tradition, and we believe that throughout the centuries, Christians in every age have had to look at their culture and test what is the biblical word for our day. And like I said, we did that around issues of race and slavery. We certainly have done it around issues of women. We still struggle with changes regarding women. Our church has moved greatly in that regard, and we need to keep doing that kind of movement. And those have been justice issues. We look at injustices, we look at inequalities, and we say, this is not faithful to our best lives as Christians, as Presbyterians, and call for change. And when we look back with clearer eyes, we see that those were the best days of the church. When we made those changes for justice, the church was at its best. And we can't always see that when we were in the middle of it, but I am sure that 100 years from now, we will see this as part of very positive change.
Can you give me a sense of personal ways in which you feel the church has let you down, and compare that to ways in which you feel that the church is just essential to your spiritual and mental health?
Well, the church is very much my community. I really am a child of the church. I've grown up, and it has been my support community, my faith community. I couldn't even think of leaving. I mean, I love this relationship. It's how I ground myself in terms of my faith and my relationships with people. So that is spiritually very fulfilling to me. I need to be there and part of this community. On the other hand, I am saddened, even angered, when I see the injustices of this institution. I believe what we are perpetuating with regard to gays and lesbians is an injustice that we just cannot continue to live with, and I will not be happy until this policy changes. But I intend to hang in there until it does, and I am fully persuaded that it will change, and I hope certainly soon and in my lifetime.
When you do something in your life that you really believe is just and morally correct, But it violates the teachings of your church. Do you feel guilty about it?
Well, I think everybody struggles with that. We know what we've been taught, we know what we believe, and whenever we make ethical decisions, we struggle with whether we're being faithful to what our understanding of our faith is. The New Testament is full of illustrations where the early Christian church struggled with its laws and its structures and its religious norms and believed that they were free to love and to be inclusive and to be just and to be a loving, caring community because of the life and ministry of Jesus Christ. And that led them into new behaviors and to new religious norms. And so in every age, we're called to do what we think is faithful. We do not always have certainty that what we are doing is indeed faithful, but we are led by our best instincts and hope that the Spirit is with us. That's all I can say is that we have, those of us certainly that have offered this report, have given it our best offering, as we say, with as much integrity as we can muster.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Sylvia Thorson-Smith was a member of the Presbyterian Church's Committee on Human Sexuality. She spoke to us from Iowa, where she teaches religious studies at Grinnell College. Copies of the report on human sexuality are available from the offices of the Presbyterian Church USA in Louisville, Kentucky. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Today we'll be hearing about the Supreme Court ruling that upheld an Indiana law that banned nude dancing from a topless bar. We'll also be hearing about the Resolution Trust Corporation's latest appeal for money on Capitol Hill and a look at the RTC's Affordable Housing Disposition Program. That's the aim of the RTC that was forced upon it, really, by Democrats in Congress to use some of the many portfolios they acquired from failed thrift institutions to make housing available to homeowners who wouldn't otherwise be able to buy.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Julia Roberts is the first actress in a long time who's been deemed a surefire box office draw, the female equivalent of a Tom Cruise or Mel Gibson. People will go and see these actors in almost anything. Film critic Stephen Schiff wonders if Roberts' status will be at risk after audiences catch her new movie, which opens today, Dying Young.
Dying Young could be the name of virtually every third TV movie these days. The disease of the week picture has become a little genre unto itself. Television's takeover of this former matinee staple may be why we don't see many big diseases on the big screen lately. And even when we do, in a movie like Terms of Endearment, it comes to us encrusted with gimcracks and gewgaws, devices designed to make us forget that what we're watching is essentially that simplest and most manipulative of storylines. Someone we like is dying, and that's sad. So it may seem almost bold of director Joel Schumacher to revive this wheezy old patient once again in its simplest form. We have Campbell Scott as an elegant San Francisco leukemia victim, and he's looking for someone to care for him while he undergoes the horrors of chemotherapy. His rich father, of course, wants him to hire some ghastly old nurse with her hair in a bun. But Scott has other ideas. And who wouldn't if Julia Roberts suddenly showed up wearing the miniest miniskirt and a grin as wide and toothy as Carlsbad Caverns?
Your father said...
Forget my father.
Well, he said you needed a nurse.
Forget what he said.
Well, if he's the one hiring...
He's not hiring. He is flying to Japan in a luxurious airplane. I am hiring. If you choose to take this job, you will be working for me, not for my father.
So why would you pick me?
Oh.
I got it. Had the shortest skirt, huh?
Oh, actually, no. There was one with a shorter skirt. But he was never a candy striper.
Roberts gets the job, of course, and then Schumacher handles the chemotherapy stuff pretty well. He's a sensationalistic director, and he's always been able to make ugly, scary things look ugly and scary. But then the chemotherapy is over, and Scott is ready to recover, however temporarily. He wants to take Roberts up to Mendocino for a vacation. And now, since he's apparently no longer dying young, and the movie has nowhere to go, the inevitable romance must blossom, and the inevitable complications must ensue. And here's where things fall apart. Because all that Schumacher and screenwriter Richard Friedenberg can come up with is a kind of paint-by-numbers class conflict. He's rich, she's poor. He's from Tony San Francisco, she's from funky Oakland. He's doing his PhD on the German Impressionists, she's never heard of any Impressionists, even the French ones. She knows who Ralph Kramden is, he doesn't. Julia Roberts is a lovely screen presence, but she seems to have trapped herself forever in Pretty Woman mode. Is she always going to play the smiley lollipop stranded among the rich truffles? Do we really need another scene like the kind we get here? Julia in a fancy restaurant staring nervously at her carpaccio, as if she'd always thought beef came cooked and ketchuped straight from the cow? In fact, the movie's big scene stealer turns out to be Campbell Scott, whom you may remember from The Sheltering Sky and Longtime Companion. Nothing he did in those films, though, could have prepared you for the star quality he radiates here. He's got an elegant, self-effacing sheen, and beneath it you feel a cool arrogance, barely contained. Scott is like a latter-day Leslie Howard, or the young Jeremy Irons. He's a thinking person's heartthrob. Now the only question is putting real-life movie stars in a banal Disease of the Week movie enough to make a thinking person want to see it?
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. Our engineers this week, Audrey Voblaitis and Thad Kirk. Chris Burgin directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet filmmaker Stephen Frears, the director of My Beautiful Laundrette, Dangerous Liaisons, and The Grifters, which just came out on home video. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.